Earlier today, a Cincinnati City Council committee discussed new restrictions on hookah bars. What could the city do to address concerns some residents have about these businesses in their neighborhoods? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about hookah bars, public safety, and quality of life issues in Cincinnati's neighborhoods are Cincinnati City Manager Cheryl Long and Chief Counsel for the City Law Department's Quality of Life Division, Mark Manning. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting us.
Great to be here.
So, City Manager Long, crime and public safety have been in the spotlight in Cincinnati for months now. Could you walk us through the policy changes the city has made when it comes to red bikes, scooters, and food trucks, and the reasons behind those changes?
Yeah, absolutely. For us, as you just mentioned, public safety is very, very important, and it's very important for us to continue to use problem solving as the root of how do we decide how we move forward to address those things that are considered concerns from our residents. And looking at the scanning and determining from the red bikes, in addition to the food trucks, those were all elements that came from CPD that they brought up to say, we really, while we understand the importance of, first of all, red bikes for mobility and for people to get around, in addition to the food trucks for entrepreneurs and people to be able to eat and freely and enjoy our city. In the same sense, I think that what we've done has gone a little bit too far, and we need to find a way to be very intentional with the time in which they actually do stop selling food and where they can sell food. And then with red bikes, as we know, there's abuse for everything. And having police officers chasing around people on bikes and noting that there was a lot of car break-ins, how do we find a way to really working with Red Bike as partner to say, while we know that you don't have the technology that we need to be able to monitor the bikes and be able to gauge where they are, let's make that a long-term plan to get across the table and do that. But in the interim, let's find a way to scale back at the time where we know things are happening to curb that violent, that the break-ins and some of those quality of life issues. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that through those measures, specifically with the red bikes, we have saw a decrease in car break-ins and things and crimes of that nature as a result of that. We have, talking to the Red Bike Board, are trying to figure out a way to give the red bike up back to those people who have memberships to kind of ease off on it a little bit. But we are very happy with the data that is stating regarding the drop as far as break-ins. Mm-hmm. And with the food trucks, those are going to be something that we're going to start looking at. We're going to scan. We're going to look at analysis, make sure we have a thorough analysis to see with the crowds how they're gathering after the bars, because they were coming up at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. Our downtown is not the way it used to be. OTR is not the way. We have a lot of residential. People want to sleep.
Yeah, I've never been downtown that late because I'm home sleeping.
Exactly. Yeah. I laugh and say, when I was growing up, you used to go to White Castle's to soak up that the
That's
food
right.
versus
yeah.
having a food truck.
That's right. Yeah.
Absolutely. Or Waffle House. So what we're just trying to do is find a way to say, we don't want to overcorrect, but we're going to just examine it. It is only restricted hours at 11 o'clock in OTR in downtown, and we'll keep a gauge on it.
Mm-hmm. And you have, as you mentioned, tried to be flexible with Red Bike. Mm-hmm. Mark, I don't know if you've got the numbers off the top of your head. The restrictions are mostly during the weekend, right, that the Red Bike restrictions are in place?
Absolutely.
Is that right?
I believe so.
Okay, City Manager
yes,
Long.
Correct.
Okay. Mark, talk about the changes to the curfew that Cincinnati City Council made and what impact some of those changes have had.
So I think the curfew made some tweaks to the ordinance in order to, I think, address it more geographically to focus, I think, on the areas of the city where there was more concern we were hearing from residents and from the police to try to target, I think, in the sense of like where the problem is at so that we're being responsive to the problem. But then in the course of doing the actual enforcement, making sure that we're doing everything that we've kind of committed to doing through the collaborative agreement process to make sure that we're not using enforcement as the first kind of lever that we pull, but we're trying to work with parents and kids to try to get them where they should be rather than out on the streets causing issues.
Mm-hmm. And that was more, if I'm remembering correctly from the ordinance change, kind of a flattening out of the ordinance. So it wasn't, there were some things that applied to some ages and not other ages. And now it's a little bit easier, at least for me to understand. Was that the idea there?
And hopefully to make it simpler for people to follow, just rather than having different classifications based on, you know, if you're 13 versus if you're 15 versus if you're 17, just to say, here's kind of, if you're under the age of 18, what we expect of you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It was more of a streamlining, because when you have that level of, Mark referenced, when you have that level of different ages, get different things, it's very difficult for an enforcement, you know, for the police officer to enforce. So how do we find a way to make it a lot easier for an enforcement mechanism? And also it's really focusing on making sure that if you're downtown, you should be with a parent. If you have a guardian with you, this is not what it is for, right? But if you are a minor that is unaccompanied by an adult, that is where we're looking at. You need to be somewhere where you're safe. And let's find a way with the curfew centers to make sure that if you are out past the time that is appropriate in a geographic area where we've seen the problem, then we will place you in these curfew centers. And then our goal, chief goal, will be to you to get reacquainted back with a adult or somebody that is a caretaker. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is thus far is people are like, well, you have the rec centers and you're paying this money and nobody's using them. Well, that is why, first of all, this is something new that we're doing. Secondly, through problem solving, you have to take time to be able to determine how does the right hand and left hand work, right? We have a large operation. We have police, we have CMO office, we have several different people that are going to have a White House, we have Seven Hills. These are all people that are going to have to be working as a team together. So we need to make sure that everybody knows what their part is and that we're doing things correctly. So we want to do this year. I wanted to do this for a whole year, knowing that we're going to see some really big peaks probably as the weather gets warmer, spring break, things like that, so that we're not scrambling to just do it and then we do something reckless, right? When we have a city of 6,000 employees, and when you are, and our department is 800 strong, or 1,000, 900 strong, it could be 1,000 is what we're compliment. So with that being said, we have to make sure that communication gets down the line to everyone. And so it's not just as easy to just do these changes operationally.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about those curfew centers. But first, I want to remind everybody, we're talking about how the city of Cincinnati is addressing quality of life issues in its neighborhoods. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. City Manager Long, you mentioned those two curfew centers, and those were really an important part of the change with the curfew policy to reassure the community and parents, hey, there's some place for these young people to go if they can't be reunited with their parent or guardian right away if they're caught after curfew. The fact that you haven't needed those yet, essentially, what does that say to you? Do you think that means the curfew policy is working? I mean, are kids just not out past curfew? What's going on there?
Well, we did a very massive rollout regarding communications to let people know, including our partners that we fund, that we are going to be approaching a curfew. So we had, there was a lot of internal communication that went to, we had a call with like 46 of our human service partners. We've been distributing education information to them for them to send out to the people that they serve. We also put signs out that says curfew is 11 o'clock for unaccompanied minors. So we have done a very robust communication strategy. And I think that has definitely helped with letting people know that if you're going to come downtown, you need to make sure that you're paired up with coming downtown. What we have seen so far is even at our transit center, because this is not something new that we've been in the business of really trying to support our youth. We've had to put resources for a community carers initiative in addition to the collaborative, our 311 community responders. And they have been helping with kids at the transit center, getting them back on buses and getting them home. But we've seen decreases in numbers for that. And I would say that is because we have been focusing on getting resources to responsible adults who are now making sure that they're there to support these kids. And that has then trickled over to that going into the weekends as well. So I'm going to take it as a win, because the goal is not to have a curfew center that has a bunch of kids in it. The goal is to just make sure that our kids are getting back home safe, and that our police are not spending hours chasing around kids when they should be focusing on larger, greater safety things.
Yeah. Mark, from a law department perspective, do you take it as a win too? I mean, do you think this, do you feel like this new curfew policy and the fact that you haven't had to fill up these curfew centers with young people who are violating curfew, has that had an impact on the kinds of trouble that you were afraid young people might be causing if they were out too late?
Yeah, and I think any time where you look at there's not a lot of enforcement of something like that in terms of like criminal charges or juvenile charges that come out of that, then I think you can count that as a win. At the end of the day, the goal is not to put kids into the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system. The goal is to, you know, improve people's quality of life where they live. And if the results, we're seeing results from that, then that's obviously a positive outcome.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about another piece of this whole puzzle, and that is, I understand there's now paid security staff that's checking IDs at the banks like late Friday and Saturday nights. And is that something that residents and businesses at the banks are funding? Is that?
Yes, absolutely. There is the banks work steering committee, the banks working group, they have a permit, a special permit that they've actually put out that is for that area with Adora. And this allows them to say, because they have a special permit, they're able to say, we want to make sure that you're 21 and up into this area. And so this is fully supported by that group. And honestly, we've seen it. We've seen really good movement with that, making sure that you're of age if you're going to be in an area where people are going to be walking around with drinking and things like that, right? And so those are things that earlier on we added to our public safety initiative very early in the summer to say, okay, we need to get a hold of this and what is something we can try. And this is something that will be there to stay. What I don't think people realize is we start planning for the summer back in January. We are, in our budget, we are making sure that we have the police enforcement. We're saying, okay, how did Wreck at Night go? How do we need to expand that? We need to go to the parks. We are literally having those conversations. But the issue is that what you don't know is what's going to happen. And interestingly, before we had our peak, we usually in Cincinnati have our peak very early, prior to 4th of July weekend. We had a large, I am a part of this large cities executive forum, and we have this, we all were on a call and a communication. I'm like, hey, is anybody having issues with their youth? And they're like, oh no, everything's fine. And then come July 4th, they're all like, hey, what are you all doing about your youth? Because we've had strategy. So this is something that is going across the country that everybody is battling with. Arizona had a curfew center. We saw, I had curfews that they activated. Everyone is doing the same things, and we're sharing with each other, sharing resources and services with each other to say we're not alone in here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know council last week approved spending an additional $5.4 million on public safety. I don't know which one of you could talk about some of the things that that's going to cover. I know it's a long list, so I won't ask you to talk about all of it, but sort of the highlights of where some of that money is going.
Yes. What is very important for us is that, yes, there's a police presence, which council doubled down and gave us more resources for that. But we also have to understand that our officers can't be everywhere, and they also have to balance work and life. So what we also had to do or are excited about is the technology aspect of it. We are continuously adding cameras to our system, cameras throughout the city. And this additional resources will help us put cameras in locations that we currently don't have. Just yesterday, I was walking out at Republican Green. I do biweekly walkthroughs in that area, and we are working with some private businesses to try to put some in certain areas around there so we can get some eyes on what happens. And that tie into Fuses, which is a real-time software that allow police to see what is going on real-time, that will be a huge added advantage for us. Because while you may not think that there are police officers there, that could be followed up with a drone coming to check out and see what, and then followed up with a police officer, and then we'll get more eyes on what is going on. And so, Mark, do you want to say?
Well, I was just going to say, Infusus is just a voluntary like system. So if property owners, they have their own security camera system, then they can choose to tie that system into the police's system, or they can choose not to. So it's kind of like a great opt-in thing that it enhances and magnifies like what the city can do with its resources without having to spend a bunch of money on adding cameras to actual physical cameras that then the city has to maintain and ensure don't break down, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Kind of a community watch, but with technology.
There
Absolutely. And those are going to be citywide, right? So we're looking at our hotspot areas that we may not have great visibility on. So really what we're looking at is, you know, our Act for Cincy, Achieving Change Together, is really the framework of how do we look at a holistic strategy to making permanent, sustainable change to addressing our violence and in addition to our safety, public safety. And I would say that that ordinance really hits on the outreach workers. It hits on the technology. It hits on every aspect of those so that they are giving us the funding to be able to do that. Gives more resource for our curfew center because we were going to have to find the money if that wasn't the case. And honestly, we wouldn't have it if we weren't fiscally managing our city appropriately, because that is another thing that is important to look at, the way that we're spending the limited resources we have. And I'm very excited about that. I think that that's going to be an added addition and support for the staff that definitely need it.
Yeah. We're talking about quality of life issues, and we're not just talking about downtown and over the Rhine. We're talking about lots of neighborhoods. So if you have questions, you can call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller on the line. Hey, Alexis, thanks so much for calling. What is your question?
Yeah, so I live in OTR, and I've lived here since 2014. I've actually talked to City Manager Long about parking. At the time, she said that finding a parking spot, if you need it, you should probably move to somewhere that has a driveway. I've continued to live in OTR because I support the neighborhood, but parking management in OTR has been hard on businesses and residents. There's no worker permits, for example, and residents are still searching for spots on dangerous streets. Greenham Republic is an example of one of them. While the garages, the resources we have, like the Hamilton County Finley Garage or the FC Garage, are largely empty outside of like big event days, I've been trying to get a working group of residents and developers and businesses to get together with the leadership of the city, because I think we have a lot of resources to solve it. And I think that if we got parking management right, it would help development in other parts of Cincinnati. But I also think it's really tied to crime. And I think having parking management where the congestion is lowered because cars know where they can park helps the street look and feel a little bit safer.
Okay.
So my question directly to City Manager Long is, help me create that working group? I think there's a lot of work we can do together that can be effective. I haven't been able to get any traction with the city though.
Okay. Thank you, Alexis. Parking, what about that working group?
Absolutely. Alexis Marsh is a big fan of the city. I mean, she has great relationships with members of Team CMO. And I think recently we have Kate Bell has been working very hand in hand with her to really get an idea of some of her concerns. And so as we talked about, parking has been an issue in OTR. We went two times at trying to get a parking plan that actually, I think the first time it was more city led, then the second was Vice Mayor got involved and worked with Mrs. Marsh to try to address that as well. And I thought that they got some compromise on that, but I still believe that there's always a moving target for, you know, that and things that we have to work on. And so what I would say is that we are focusing on making sure that all of our team is showing up when they can and we're addressing what we can, but we are never going to be able to make everyone happy. But Kate Bell in my office has been very good partners with Ms. Marsh. And so we will continue to have those conversations.
And one of the things I think, too, that we've spent a lot of time trying to do over the last couple of years, especially in Over the Rhine, has been trying to be more efficient and effective at doing on-street parking enforcement, because I know that's the focus of so many complaints from residents, that the street parking is being taken up by folks who aren't residents and getting enforcement of that the resident parking permit program. And so I know just within the last few months that's been a focus of the city and trying to coordinate between the police department and parking enforcement and making sure that that's kind of being covered on a holistic level.
In addition to the money that we, for instance, just got from council, that's to support some of the towing efforts so that people aren't just parking their cars and just sitting there for long, that we actually have resources to, for ourselves, to fund a tow truck to pick up the cars and take them off. And we've been consistently doing that in OTR in addition to the banks and everywhere as well. So we have, and like you mentioned, parking enforcement, the city has put millions of dollars to making sure that we've increased the amount of parking enforcement attendants that we have. That has been a priority in the budget, and we are seeing great traction with that too. So we are committed, as Mark said, to making sure that we look at the enforcement, making sure people that are parking there are really supposed to be parking there. And then we've always continued to have conversations with our residents and making sure Team CMO is showing up when they can.
Okay. Well, we are going to continue our conversation and talk about hookah bars next after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. Have you already been thinking about November's election? Join me in our new building at 8 p.m. September 24th for a live politics show. Get more information and register to attend at wvxu.org. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about how the city of Cincinnati is addressing quality of life concerns in its neighborhoods, and we're going to talk about what the city is considering when it comes to hookah bars. My guests are Cincinnati City Manager Cheryl Long and Chief Counsel for the City Law Department's Quality of Life Division, Mark Manning. If you've got questions or comments for them, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So at the very start of our conversation, I mentioned that City Council, a committee today, was considering some restrictions when it comes to hookah bars. Neighbors in Clifton and Roselawn have expressed concern about hookah bars near their homes. In Roselawn, there was a shooting. There are reported cases of parties spilling into the street on Ludlow and Clifton, blocking an emergency vehicle. City Council candidate Steve Gooden tells us people have fired shots in the air and are selling alcohol out of cars. What are you all hearing from neighbors when it comes to hookah bars?
So it's largely what you just said. You know, this isn't a new problem. While I think it's garnered some more, I think, public attention in the last few months, it's been a problem that's kind of been growing, or at least has been in existence for the last several years. I think really post-pandemic, we saw kind of a great increase in the number of hookah establishments here in the city. And over the last several years, we've been kind of struggling with dealing with those in the same way that we deal with many of our businesses that are open at nights, nightclubs, bars, that sorts of thing. But what makes hookah different from perhaps as other businesses that typically those have to go through kind of a thorough licensing process that's run through the state of Ohio.
Those other businesses, bars and things.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Versus hookah bars, which there's no direct licensing because for the most part, they're prohibited by their operation by the Ohio Workplace Smoking Ban. So you can't smoke inside a public place here in the state of Ohio, which would include most hookah establishments. And to be able to basically have an exemption from that, you have to apply to the state of Ohio, and most of these places don't obtain that exemption. So
does that mean they're illegally operating?
That's correct. But I think what we have seen is that from the state level, the tools that kind of are governing the enforcement of that haven't always been the most effective. What the General Assembly said, here's how you should address this, which is basically we issue notices of violations and a fine. That for many places where that is their entire business, they're just going to pay the fine as a cost of doing business. And so it becomes incumbent on the police department, the health department, the law department to work together, and especially the places where we're seeing a connection or a nexus to violent criminal activity to try to do what we can to mitigate the harm on the community as best we can.
Do these establishments typically stay open a lot later than a lot of bars, too? How does that or does that contribute to the situation?
Correct. So there is here in the state of Ohio, you have to close, depending on your class of liquor permit, you usually have to close by 2:30. That doesn't mean that you have to stop serving and take the alcohol back by 2:30, which I think for most bars and nightclubs means you're closing at 2:30. But you could theoretically stay open after that. You have a lot of these other hookah-type establishments that kind of enter into that gap of time after hours when all these other bars close, and they are offering a service to clientele that usually have been at these other establishments that are now closed. They've been consuming alcohol for several hours and are looking for somewhere to go, something to do. And these are the only type of establishments that are open. So you have the accumulation of alcohol in people's system over the course of an entire night, then playing its way through, you know, what happens at some of these establishments, the hookahs in particular.
Yeah. I know the city and the health department have filed a lawsuit against the hookah lounge in Clifton. Can you talk about the allegations there?
Since it's pending litigation, I don't want to get into the specifics of that, but okay. Maybe more in general, talking just about our hookah enforcement, typically, you know, the police department, the vice unit, they've been incredibly effective over the last several years at, I think, going after problem nightclubs, bars, and including hookah establishments. We've filed, I think it's something around 10 lawsuits about hookah-related establishments since 2023. So this isn't, like I said, something we've been just paying attention to the last couple of months. Because Vice and the police department have been very effective at working with health at addressing those problems, and particularly the ones that are, I think, governing a lot of, are creating a lot of community concern. So we typically will, the places where there are complaints from the community, the police department will make contact with those individuals. Like most of our bar type problems, we tend to try to engage the ownership to say, we're having issues here. Do you agree that there are problems? What are you seeing? How can we help you be effective, help you be successful as a business owner here in the city? Are you complying with your obligations here? And if you're not, then obviously over the course of those conversations, sometimes enforcement becomes necessary, and that leads to like litigation being filed, as occurred in these cases I just described.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and I mentioned City Council is considering some restrictions for hookah bars. Can maybe City Manager Long, do you mind walking me through a little bit of what council discussed earlier today?
Absolutely. I think the main goal is that we are trying to close in, or council is trying to, from a policy, we can only enforce what they make policy, right? And so they're trying to find a way to make something that is enforceable, that is within line with what the community is wanting. And so I think it's very important for us to be responsive in that way. And all together, my conversations have been with council is, what do we want with our downtown? What do we want with our nightlife? There's a lot of things that have popped up that probably what is on the books does not mimic some of these things that are now new and that we're seeing that pop up in the community. So we need to make sure that council, as the policy body, is bringing forward laws that we can then enforce that is speaking to what our residents want to see. And I think that is essentially what council is trying to address all over the place, not in just with the hookah bars, but we're even having conversations with the bars, right? And is it appropriate, you know, as far as the timing and the 2:30? There's been people talking about that time with their liquor license and things like that. So we just need them as a guiding light, and I'm happy that they're doing this to be a policy body of letting us know what residents want so that we can then enforce what those things are.
Yeah. And are they mostly focused on closing these establishments earlier than they've been closing? Is that the
main
gist of it?
Yes, absolutely. I think Mark may have a little bit, but yeah, the goal is because right now it's not necessarily, they don't sell liquor. So there's really anything on the books that speaks to a hookah lounge and what times they close. And this will make that more specific and give us better rules so that when somebody does call the police, and that's another thing going a little bit around, but it's important for our residents to, we get a lot of videos and things talking about what's happening, which is great. That helps. But if we can get, you know, from 311 or 911 are calling so that we can show up, so our police can actually show up as well while those things are happening, that helps us get some data of some stuff as well to give recommendations to council when we're seeing things too. We may not be able to close it down. They might be, be in compliance of things, or we can give a warning after the fact. But in the same sense, that simple call does a lot for us as well. And that helps us give council more directions to as well as where we need to go.
So maybe make the call before you start taking the video. Is that the message, or
any way that people, I think, become engaged in the process is a positive one. The most beneficial one is when they report to the police, whether by emergency or non-emergency, so we know at a minimum that it happens. I know that sometimes people get frustrated with response times and things like that on the weekends, but I consistently tell people it's better to have said something, and that way we have a record that it occurred, and we can always follow up later. And there's oftentimes in the world we live in, with cameras being just kind of ubiquitous, that we have the opportunity to go back and say, okay, well, what happened here? Let's collect it, especially where it's a recurring problem. We can kind of focus our resources and make sure that we're being responsive.
We got an email from Julie. Julie writes, all the laws in the world depend on enforcement. In my neighborhood, Cuff, there is little enforcement of parking regulations with signage clearly in place and trash all over the streets and loud noise ordinance, very seldom enforced, and graffiti in the laws governing rental buildings in terms of amount of non-related people allowed, et cetera, et cetera. Start enforcing the laws in place. That will go a long way to improve quality of life. Julie has a lot in that email, obviously, to break down, but those are all, I'm sure, issues that could be problematic for residents. What does enforcement consist of when you're looking at those issues? Maybe I'll start with you, Mark. How is it tough to, you know, untangle all those different things, or are some of those things related to each other?
I mean, most of our enforcement is driven by complaints from the community where people see issues and they report them to us and we go follow up as best we can. You know, so when you're talking about in cuff, oftentimes, you know, we'll receive kind of a general complaint about the things that individuals are saying, like, here's what I'm seeing here, there are recurring problems in my community. It's then incumbent on us to go out, investigate, gather evidence, figure out what's actually occurring here, and then what can we do with what we can prove at that point. And that always doesn't always meet, I think, people's expectations as to what they want to see. And the best that we can say to people is that we're going to keep trying. If you keep bringing it to our attention, we're going to keep going out here. And, you know, I have, in my time at the city, I always tell the attorneys in our division that this is the best job because no matter what happens, we win. Either the problem has ceased occurring or ultimately we take some action to fix it. And no matter what happens, the community should see a better outcome as a result of it. And I know that that doesn't always percolate down to people on the streets, but it really takes a committed effort to say, okay, I'm going to keep reporting this and keep bringing it to the city's attention because that consistent touching of like the city's processes lets us go out there and do our jobs.
Well, I imagine sometimes it takes a while for things to work through the courts too. If it comes to court action, that doesn't always happen quickly.
100%. And for example, like sometimes people see something that they think might be occurring, like the unrelated people living in a house, that sort of thing. And we go investigate. But ultimately, if they don't want to talk to us, then it's incumbent on us to, well, do we need a search warrant to go in and search this stuff? So we have to use different legal tools. And sometimes the Constitution says we can't do something here. And so and I know that that's frustrating to folks, but that's why I say it's important to keep following up, to keep reporting things that you're seeing, because you never know when will be the time that enough things have happened that lets us go get a search warrant, that lets us follow up and file a lawsuit. So it's consistency that's really important.
Yeah, you need to reach that tipping point, I guess.
Correct.
Okay. Well, we need to take another short break. We will be back to discuss Governor DeWine's visit last week. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back to finish our conversation about how the city of Cincinnati is addressing quality of life issues in its neighborhoods, and we're going to talk about Governor DeWine's visit last week. My guests are Cincinnati City Manager Cheryl Long and Chief Counsel for the City Law Department's Quality of Life Division, Mark Manning. You can join the conversation. Just call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So Governor DeWine was here last week to talk about the partnership between the city and the state to work to reduce crime. There's a lot going on there. I'll start with you, City Manager Long. What do you think is the most important help the city is getting from the state within this partnership?
Well, I would start to say that the city and the state, this is not a unique relationship that CPD is working with the state. I think that's very important, and it's something that our officers have been really frustrated to people think that this is new. We are and will continue to collaborate with other law enforcement agencies to make sure we're doing what we can to make sure Cincinnati is safe. But what we specifically were addressing is the added layer of on some of our areas are very hot spot trying to go after the shooters. That collaboration is a little bit different than what we've had before. Pairing up a CPD officer in addition to a state trooper to really address those areas where we're seeing a surge in violent crime. And what was very important for us is we are very proud of our collaborative agreement, and we wanted to make sure that the state was going to respect and also understand the importance of the collaborative agreement while they're working in our streets, which is a different level of detective work. You won't see them. They will be in there, but it is definitely a behind-the-scenes type of effort. And we're starting off kind of a slow rollout to see how this works, right? Again, I speak to when you talk about having different agencies, when you talk about different departments, these are all knowing what the right hand and left hand are doing, making sure everybody understands their role. these are very big operations that we're trying to deploy, and we want to make sure that everybody is safe while doing that, our officers in addition to the residents. And so I'm very excited about how the governor was really embracing that and being supportive of that, and making sure that that he understood the troopers were. And so I think that is the major thing, the violent crime. Nobody wants to be a victim. It is terrible to have anybody lose their life to gun violence. And there are a very small percentage of people that are out there committing these crimes. And so getting additional support to focus on that is, I think, is very important. And CPD already has, from their CJIC, and we already have a lot of commitment, great people who are men and women who are doing that work. But to enhance that and bring people part of the team is going to be huge.
Yeah. It's kind of the extra boots on the ground, so to speak, but not in a way that's going to be super visible to residents of the city.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you about a couple specific elements of the partnership. Cincinnati City Council candidate Linda Matthews wrote a recent op-ed. I'm not sure if you saw this in the Inquirer. She said the city turned down help from the governor to locate parolees who violate their post-release control agreements. Is that correct?
That is not correct.
Okay.
In fact, in the agreement, we are getting help with our parole and locating parolees. We have not turned that down.
Okay. Well, and she also wrote that the city turned down help from the Ohio Narcotics Intelligence Center and Ohio Investigative Unit. Is that correct? Are you familiar with that piece of it?
That would be confusing to me only because we work so frequently with those units that we work hand in hand with them constantly, especially on dealing with problem locations and trying to, because one of the things I think people, they want to see individuals, they want to see police officers out on street corners, but one of the things I think that's important for the city is having a long-term sustainable outcome here for residents, not just flooding the streets with officers, whether they be troopers or police officers, for a few weeks during the summer, but to say we want to make streets safer 52 weeks a year, 365 days a year, and how do we follow up on we have this opportunity here to do enforcement, to make places safer, because, you know, it's not just about looking at offenders, but also the places that are contributing to the violence, and working so closely between our vice unit, CJIC, and also the Ohio Investigative Unit to make sure we're being comprehensive and can produce sustainable outcomes for neighborhoods, I think, is a goal.
Yeah. Do you have any idea where information like that might have come from? Has there been confusion about this partnership or kind of misunderstandings about the partnership?
I know we were very deliberate working with the governor. We did a press conference that spoke to the partnership. We've been very transparent about that. I don't know where the confusion is coming from, but I do know that our goal and what we were wanting to do in addition to is to make sure that we were communicating and transparent and letting people know what it was. So mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay.
Honestly.
Let's talk about just generally how the city uses or considers using public nuisance laws to address quality of life concerns. Can you walk us through that, Mark? Because I think that's something that your department and division has been very active with.
Yes, very much so. I think over the last few years under this manager and this mayor, it's been a real focus for us in terms of, I think, two things. One, focusing on areas of the city that are contributing to violent crime and reducing that. So you kind of heard a little bit about that earlier with Hookah. But the second piece of it is improving the housing stock of our residents. And so over the last several years, increasing the number of cases we're filing to try to improve people's quality of life, their housing conditions, whether it comes to the actual physical conditions, their unit, the trash, litter, are things broken that need to be fixed, heat, that sort of thing, or, you know, also when it comes to crime, making sure that some of these where crime is occurring in apartment complexes or things of that nature, that they're getting addressed. And so over the last few years, I think we have filed cases of about over 1,000 units of housing in the city each year. I think the exception being, I think 2021, it was just under 1,000, it was like 990 or something like that. And right now we have, around 3,000 units currently in some sort of like project or litigation here and within our group, which is according to the census at least, about 2% of the city's total housing stock. And so trying to work with police, trying to work with the building department, the health department, to increase our reach as much as we can, to reach as many residents as we can with the resources that we have.
And those cases that you talked about, those are all over the city, right? Or are those concentrated in specific neighborhoods?
No, they're all over the city most of the time, because we don't, you know, we're focused on particular bad actors, just like the police might with offenders. We go after bad landlords, and you see consistently what is a bad landlord is somebody who's been bad in the past, and sometimes they're bad in the future, until you intervene and try to address that and work to solve the problem. And so many of our cases, they impact thousands of units, but there's only two or three of those cases. Like right now, we just filed a case within the last couple of weeks against a company called Second Avenue that kind of corresponds with a case that also got filed by the residents of Second Avenue to address. They're all single family houses, and those are all spread all over the city. It's almost 1,000 single family houses. And of course, we have ongoing litigation about the Visitor and Beyond portfolio. The Williamsburg apartment complex is something that is still ongoing, hopefully coming to a close here shortly. That was, I think, newsworthy several years ago, but it's still working its way through the court system, hopefully with a great outcome with a new owner. But cases like that, including, I think we filed a lawsuit against a company called REM last year and things like that. So it's probably at least a half dozen pieces of what I would describe as major litigation, where we are going after conditions-related issues. But then on the flip side of it, we're also trying to be creative and address other problems that the city is seeing. For example, we brought litigation against Kia and Hyundai within the last couple of years to try to address the epidemic of car thefts and break-ins of cars, because they made a decision early on in their design process to omit certain types of key, like safety hardware, basically, that makes the vehicle easy to steal. And while every other, it seems like, developed country in the world required this piece of equipment, the United States did not. And so they made a business decision to omit it. And then as a result, you know, over the last several years, I think it's something like half of our auto thefts are Kia and Hyundais. And it's kind of ubiquitous, where you see a high profile, terrible event that happens in the city and it involves a stolen car. And, you know, I would bet a dollar every single time that it's a Kia or a Hyundai, and it usually is.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, we believe in supporting the whole person. So Mayor and Council has allowed us to continue with access to counsel, making sure not only are we going after the bad landlords, but we're also giving resource. I think it's like $1.5 million that we put each year to make sure that we're keeping residents in their home, because we understand that once you are unhoused and don't have, that is where the breakdown starts, right? And pathways is what we've doing to $1 million a year to make sure that we're providing people opportunities to work for City Hall and giving them access to city jobs and things like that. So I think the things that we've been focusing on is, and what Act for Cincy basically says, is we have to look at the whole person. These things that people are very frustrated with, and they have the right to do so. They are because people are suffering. And how do we be very intentional with where we're putting our dollars and servicing the whole person? And I'm proud of what this administration has been able to do in that.
Well, these lawsuits against landlords that you were talking about, Mark, I mean, it is really difficult. Our colleague Nick Swartzel and our colleague Becca Costello, they've done a lot of reporting on this. And people can be living in terrible conditions, but they're almost afraid to complain sometimes because they don't want their housing to be condemned, because then they have no place to go.
Right.
How do you walk that tightrope to make sure you're giving people the help they need, you're improving the housing stock and the quality, but they still need some place to live?
You mean in terms of just making sure they don't get displaced?
Correct.
Yes. So, I mean, that I think is a focus of us, because, you know, it consistently comes up in like HUD housing, for example, where there's a project base. And I think HUD's interest is in the money that they provide and not necessarily the structure itself. And so they want to have that the tenants of their buildings have safe, sanitary, secure housing, which is great. And we work very closely with HUD, but then oftentimes they'll make a decision, enforcement related, to say, we need to move the tenants out of here because it's so bad. And then it leaves the shell of that building left behind. And then it becomes the city's problem to deal with and the community's problem to deal with once the money has been removed. So And I say that because HUD works very closely with us. We have a great relationship. I'm trying to prevent that from ever happening. But it's, I think, always preferable to us to try to improve people's quality of life where they live rather than displace them, because the just the cost to the city, the cost to the community of big, large vacant buildings that have to be torn down becomes monumental in many ways. And so incrementally trying to deal with deferred maintenance before you get to the point of no return with a structure that's just in such condition that it has to be torn down is part of the strategy to say, let's intervene earlier, let's meet people where they're at and try to protect them as best we can, because it doesn't just help them, it helps the entire community and make sure that this housing stock is secure for the long term.
And with that, the city is working with CDF. And for those landlords that are being great landlords, there's NOFA. There's plenty of opportunities for people who are doing what they're supposed to, but may just have a resource issue, to work with us so that we can give them loan them or they can receive resources to get their properties back on the other track through our Department of Economic Development. And that's, for us, it's important for collaboration, because you're right, you don't want to displace, you don't want people to be unhoused, but then also from the receivers, how do you get good landlords to help support these other people to get things back in the conditions we need to? And this is going to take a long runway. The work that Mark and him have been doing, it needs consistent support so that they can continue to do that and chip away. But housing product is getting old. They were new at one time. Now there's a lot of maintenance, the wear and tear. And just like your own home, when you're not putting money away to take care of it, then obviously it gets to the point where that price tag is huge. So we're trying to, on many different ways, try to see what we can to support and get people in the quality conditions that they deserve.
Well, we're running short on time, but in the minute or so we have left, I want to give you all the opportunity to talk about something positive that you're hearing from residents about quality of life. Are you getting any feedback that, hey, that's really working? I mean, I know you're very solutions oriented and you're trying to tackle problems. I don't mean to throw you a curveball, but can you come? Do you have any thoughts on that?
City manager?
You're just so focused on the problems, you're like keeping your head down.
You know, I think that's the thing. I think the voices we hear, there's a lot of the silent that we don't hear because they're so busy with doing their day-to-day, right?
Their life, yeah.
And so at the end of the day, as public servants, we're not accustomed to getting the good job. We're accustomed to fixing. And that's what we will continue to do with the support of problem solving. So what I do know is these dollars that I'm talking about, the access to counsel, those are life-changing. They have helped a lot of people. The retainers in some of the apartment complexes that we got in good hands of, you know, of landlords that are reputable, those are people who are coming to us because they've seen what we've done to other people and they need our help. So people are coming to us to intervene and speaking about things that we've done elsewhere and saying we want it too. And for me, that means that we're doing things that are working. We just need resources to be able to do it.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati City Manager Cheryl Long and Chief Counsel for the City Law Department's Quality of Life Division, Mark Manning. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out our website, wvxu.org, to get more information about our September 24th politics show. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.